You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, more than 80% of young fathers attend at least one ultrasound with their partner during pregnancy. We talked to a Wisconsin researcher who's been studying how to better support fathers who want to be more involved before and after childbirth. Now, President Biden had his first meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin this week. The leaders released a joint statement on their commitment to nuclear arms control and building a more stable relationship with one another. But there are still big disagreements on things like human rights, Ukraine, and Russian cyber attacks on U.S. infrastructure that are probably going to be harder to resolve. We're talking now about the U.S.-Russia relationship, how it will be different under President Biden than in the previous administration. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on Biden's first meeting with Putin? What do you think Biden needs to do differently, if anything? What questions do you have about the relationship between the two presidents and the countries they represent? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Yoshiko Herrera is a professor of political science at UW-Madison. She specializes in Russian politics and U.S.-Russia relations. Yoshiko, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
What were your first impressions of what came out of this meeting yesterday?
Well, I think that the Biden administration did a good job in lowering expectations. So I guess my initial impression was it was fine, in the sense that there were no major problems. There were no embarrassments, no excessive promises. And on balance, I think the Biden administration, or at least President Biden in his comments, emphasized a return to some kind of more normal channels of communication, which I generally think is a good outcome.
And you mentioned the expectations game. We saw, George W. Bush as president saying he looked into Putin's soul and liked what he saw there. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton with his grand reset idea of U.S.-Russian relations. Is it a good thing, do you think, to dial down expectations and figure out areas, maybe smaller areas, that can be starting points toward cooperation?
Yeah, well, at this point, Putin has been in power for over 20 years, and he's done a lot of things, and we have a pretty good sense of who he is. So we don't really have to guess at what kind of person he is at this point. I think, though, that the personal politics, which President Biden emphasized, probably is important in terms of diplomacy. And one thing I was struck by is that whereas the Russian media had portrayed Biden fairly frequently as sort of old, senile, et cetera, and Putin in his comments specifically addressed that and made a more positive case for Biden, saying he's knowledgeable, experienced, on top of things, and I think spoke in rather complimentary terms. So in a way, I think there was a more pragmatic acknowledgement of differences between the countries, but generally more pragmatic as opposed to emotional or hyperbolic approach.
One of the big points of disagreement between Russia and the U.S., human rights. Biden said he brought up the Russian dissident Alexei Navalny and two U.S. citizens currently imprisoned in Russia. Can you give us some background on these issues?
Yeah. So Navalny is, to the extent there is an opposition in Russia, he would be the leader of it. He faced an assassination attempt last August with the chemical Novichok, which was in the news. He was airlifted in a coma out of the country to Germany for medical assistance. The Putin regime would have loved for him to stay out of the country, to stay in Europe. But Navalny very courageously went back to Russia with a message that ordinary Russians need to stand up to the regime and not be afraid. He was immediately arrested and put in prison again. And so there's concern that Navalny may be killed while he's in prison. He was on a hunger strike for a while, so situation is very dire, but seems to be a little bit more stable. But that's a very it's a very sad situation. And the Navalny case shows that Putin's regime is more and more willing to use violence to stay in power. So it's one person, but it's kind of symbolic of the lengths the regime is willing to go to stay in power. The other Americans, I don't know if you want me to say any more about that, but that's sort of more in terms of the U.S.-Russia relation, and the low point it has come to is that we can't really even discuss Americans who are imprisoned there.
Talking to Yoshiko Herrera, professor of political science at UW-Madison. She specializes in Russian politics and U.S.-Russian relations. We're looking at the meeting between Presidents Biden and Putin yesterday. Some of you, for technical reasons that I don't fully understand, may have lost that broadcast for a little while. Yoshiko said lower expectations at this meeting between the two presidents were a big feature of it. You can join in, by the way, with your reactions and thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or your questions for our guest about yesterday's meeting and wider issues between Russia and the U.S. The number is 800-642-1234. Yoshiko, of course, we're here in the U.S. I think we see Russia through an American lens. Can you talk a little bit about how Putin views his relationship with the United States and how he kind of sells that to the Russian public?
Yeah, this is one of his propaganda tools, which is that he portrays the West as aggressive, as violating international laws and norms, and essentially out to get Russia. And he portrays himself as the protector of Russia and the only person who can stand up to the West and keep Russia safe. So the anti-Western sentiment is aggressively pushed by Putin and his propaganda machine. And so he likes to highlight any problems that he sees in the U.S. But one thing I will say is that although it is a propaganda talking point, it does resonate with people in Russia because the experience of World War II is still something that is significant there, and the idea of being threatened by Europe, threatened by the U.S. and the Cold War, et cetera, just still resonates with people.
Yeah, can you talk about those longstanding themes? I happen to be reading a biography of Catherine the Great back in the 1700s. She just annexed Crimea, as Putin just did, and just installed basically a puppet government in a neighboring state, in that case, Poland. That interest in what's going on right on Russian borders, this is a longstanding concern in Russia, whatever the government might look like, right?
Yes. And actually, I would say a lot of the discourse of strategic stability, which is talked about in the summit, that has a specific meaning in U.S. circles, but for Russians, to a lot of extent, to the Putin regime anyways, that means a buffer zone, and that means staying out of our backyard. The U.S. has already encroached on that buffer zone with the expansion of NATO and the Baltic states, and that's what made Ukraine somewhat of a flashpoint for Russia and a serious issue in U.S.-Russia relations, because Russia had thought that Ukraine was going to join NATO and possibly join the EU. And that's what, to some extent, makes the support for the violent regime of Lukashenko congruent with Putin's interests, even though Putin doesn't need Lukashenko per se, but he doesn't want U.S. or NATO influence in that region. Same with Central Asia, but the U.S. is not as actively involved there.
Now, domestically, President Biden has gotten some criticism from some Republicans, including Senator Ron Johnson here in Wisconsin, and some Democrats. So when it comes to this pipeline that will connect Russian natural gas with Germany, the Biden administration basically said, we don't like this project, we're opposed to it, but decided not to maintain sanctions on a key subsidiary company. It's a complicated story, owned by a Russian company that's building this pipeline. Is this an important story? How big a deal is it?
Well, you know, there's kind of two parts to this story. There's a political story where especially East European governments, Baltic states, Ukraine, to some extent, would like to isolate Russia and punish them. And they think that by not buying oil and gas from Russia, this will be a way to punish Russia because its economy is so reliant on oil and gas sales. The other side of the story is there is a business issue of European oil and gas companies want oil and gas in particular from Russia. So the business side of the story is that, you know, consumers, businesses, et cetera, want energy supplies. And energy companies want to sell energy. So there's a little bit of a disconnect between what business circles and consumers want and what politicians and political leaders want. But, you know, energy is both a business and a political matter for Russia. So that's what complicates it. And it seems that the Biden administration has, in this particular round, gone with, you know, allowing the business side of things to continue.
We are talking about Biden and Putin, the U.S. and Russia, relationships amongst them. Yoshika Herrera is with us, professor of political science at UW-Madison, who specializes in U.S.-Russian relations. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Russia and the U.S. have had a difficult relationship, understatement there, for a long time. Do you see that changing anytime soon? Do you want to see cooperation on issues? Would you like to see a harder line from Biden on Russia? If so, what does that mean to you? What would that look like? Call it at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with UW-Madison political scientist Yoshika Herrera about the state of U.S.-Russian relations in the wake of President Biden's first summit with Putin. You can join in if you have questions, reactions yourself at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Another issue that came up, Yoshika, at the event is cyber attacks. Here's Biden at a press conference after his meeting with Putin talking about cyber attacks coming apparently from Russian soil on U.S. infrastructure.
I talked about the proposition that certain critical infrastructure should be off limits to attack, period, by cyber or any other means. I gave them a list.
And this comes after the story of an American fuel pipeline hacking attack, apparently based in Russia, though not a Russian state actor. Could you talk about the prospects, Yoshiko, for cooperation on that issue?
Yeah, I think that was an interesting aspect where Biden seemed to hint that he had hinted about some kind of retaliation from the U.S. on that. So I think that was an interesting sort of strong statement from Biden. But one thing I will say is that, you know, cyber hackers are not government employees typically. So they exist out there in the world, and there is a certain amount that governments can do to stop them, but they don't necessarily follow government directives. So I think there's, in that sense, space for cooperation between the two countries. But the government of Russia has also tried to utilize or support hacking in different areas, as we know. So, I mean, it's not a very trustworthy partner. So on the one hand, we have some incentives for cooperation. On the other hand, Putin is not a trustworthy partner. But I don't know. It's possible that there can be some progress in this area.
And when people think Russia and hacking, they might think of state-sponsored efforts to influence elections in the United States and in other countries around the world. Did you get a sense that came up, that was an important issue at yesterday's meeting?
I don't know if the election hacking per se versus the more recent oil and gas company hacking. But I think that it's clear. Biden said that he noted 16 areas where cybersecurity was important, and he hinted at some kind of retaliation by the U.S. So I don't know that the election hacking came up per se, but cybersecurity definitely was one of the things they talked about.
Talking to Yoshiko Herrera with UW-Madison, professor of political science and an expert in Russian politics and U.S.-Russia relations, looking at yesterday's meeting between Presidents Biden and Putin. And Yoshiko, I think a lot of people were watching was, what is going to be different under President Biden meeting with Putin as compared to a President Trump? Obviously, some differences stylistically and beyond. What do you see as some of the key differences there?
Well, Trump's foreign policy generally was very erratic and unpredictable. As most people recall, like, he said personally nice personal things about Putin. But on the other hand, the sanctions remained in place and actually were strengthened, partly because Congress did not trust Trump's ability to handle a foreign policy. So Russia could not necessarily be happy with the Trump foreign policy, with the one exception, which is that Trump's the division that he sowed between the United States and NATO is just something Russia could never have dreamed possible. And so he gave this big gift to them of a gap between the U.S. and NATO. And I think that is going to be closed, if not already closed, with the Biden administration. So one thing I think that is going to be different is that the United States is going to probably work much more closely with Europe and certainly more closely with NATO allies. But we cannot really expect a huge amount of change as long as Putin is in power, because he is a dictator who is quite committed to staying in power and to using violence to maintain his power. So there's sort of limits on the cooperation with Putin.
I know there's a certain element of diplomacy journalism when people try to watch for, oh, who arrived first? What was their posture? Did they sit? Did they hold a press conference together? Which they didn't. They held their own press conferences. I don't know how much that matters. Did you see anything in just the form of this meeting and what came before and after that you thought was significant?
Yeah, I thought there was a couple of interesting things. The U.S. side made the request that Putin arrive first. That's because Putin has this psychological tactic of keeping people waiting, so they didn't want to deal with that. Putin did arrive first. When Biden arrived, he is the first one that reached out to shake Putin's hand. And I think that's indicative of President Biden's sort of optimistic, pragmatically optimistic approach. The two separate press conferences was probably done out of concern to keep things under control. But those press conferences actually both were pretty civil and I would say reasonably positive. I was pleasantly surprised with the tone coming out of both. I mean, Biden was definitely more optimistic, but in terms of optics, I think it's maybe as good as it could have been. You know, there was no White House invitation, which I think would have been a disaster and not something President Biden was likely to do anyways. And that didn't happen, which is, you know, a plus, but also expected.
Looking at Putin's role in Russia, and you mentioned he's very committed to staying in power. He's been in, for 20 years as president or prime minister. And when he switches offices, it seems like he just moves the power along with him. Are there prospects for change in Russia? What would it take to get to a post-Putin country?
Well, you know, amazingly, during the pandemic last year, he managed to change the constitution essentially to get rid of term limits for himself. So he is able to stay in power for a long time. He doesn't show any signs of being willing to give up power. But, you know, people don't live forever. So there's a natural limit to any one individual's reign, no matter what constitutional maneuvers they have put through. So it does not look like Putin is eager or willing to step down. And one of the tactics that he uses to stay in power is to keep any potential alternatives to him, anyone who seems even remotely competent or reasonable as an alternative, off the stage, prevent them from running for election, prevent them from having any kind of prominent role. So and that's one of the reasons why Alexei Navalny is still in prison, is that Putin, you know, he meticulously curates potential rivals. So we don't see any now, but that doesn't mean that one could not arrive on the scene and I mean, my sense is the fragility of his support is such that if there were, if an alternative were to come up, his support may crumble quite quickly.
In just our last minute or so, Yoshiko, I mean, the public and we in the media see the high-profile meeting, the president and the president. I understand a lot of the important work, though, gets done by lower-level negotiators, things like that. What kind of things are you watching for that might be happening behind the scenes to untangle some of the issues we've been talking about?
The number one thing I'm looking for is the return of diplomatic ties, the reopening of our embassy and our consulates, and the reinstatement of the ability for Russians and Americans to travel back and forth. People may not realize, but all of our consulates are closed and all of our visas have been shut down to all but diplomatic visas. So there's very little way for Russians or Americans to travel back and forth. And that includes students, professionals, everyone. And so if we want to have dialogue and connections, that kind of thing, which may seem small scale, is actually a very important thing to get restarted.
Yoshiko, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. You're welcome.
That was Yoshiko Herrera, professor of political science at UW-Madison. She specializes in U.S.-Russian relations. She joined us for a look at the meeting between President Biden and Russian President Putin yesterday and what it all means for relationships between the two countries. Now, more and more young fathers are choosing to be more engaged in the prenatal care experience with their pregnant partners. More than 80% surveyed in a new study said they attended at least one ultrasound, for example. Our next guest has been conducting studies to try to figure out what kind of involvement dads want, what kind of support their partners want, and what care providers can do to better inform and educate new dads. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you are a dad, do you wish you were more or less involved during the mom's pregnancy? Did you get to most appointments or some appointments with her? And in early childcare, how big a role did you want to play? How big a role were you able to play? Maybe you were the one going into work at that time. What kind of challenges were there? And whoever you are, do you think attitudes in fatherhood and about fatherhood are changing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Tova Walsh is an assistant professor of social work at UW-Madison and an affiliate at the Institute for Research on Poverty at UW-Madison. She's been working on several studies related to fathers' involvement in prenatal care and early childhood. Tova, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, before we get into some of your research, Tova, can you, again, this is Tova Walsh with UW-Madison. Before we get into your research, Tova, can you talk about what we know about how much of a difference it makes if dads are involved prenatal and postnatal in caring for kids?
Yeah. So, you know, postnatally, we know that when fathers are involved, actively involved in responsive ways with their children, that children benefit in so many different ways. So across pretty much every domain of development, social development, cognitive development, academic achievement, we just see all kinds of benefits to kids of having a positively involved father. And one of the exciting things that research is showing more recently is that the relationship starts even before birth. And so that when fathers have the opportunity to be involved and engaged in pregnancy, that benefits outcomes for baby, for mother, and for fathers too. So starting to form a bond with the baby, supporting a mom and having a healthy pregnancy, that those things really matter and set the stage for involvement after the baby is born.
You've done work on this now, both with surveys, but also just getting talking to dads about their feelings about this, about their involvement. What kind of things did you hear directly from dads about how much they want to be involved with those prenatal appointments for the mom?
I've heard from dads that it's really important to them to be present. And so, you know, especially for some of the more milestone kind of appointments, so things like a prenatal ultrasound, that feels particularly important, or a first appointment and hearing the baby's heartbeat. But for some fathers, they want to be there at every visit and they feel like, you know, it's both part of supporting the mom, but it is also about themselves and taking on the role of a father and showing up for their child at these healthcare appointments. And it's so important to them that a lot of dads go to really tremendous effort to be there. So when I've interviewed fathers in prenatal care settings, you know, I talked to one dad who was a truck driver who had driven all night to get back in time and, you know, without rest, kind of came straight to this appointment. It meant so much to him to be there. So it's really meaning a lot to fathers to be present.
And there's also some gauging of how much they want or need to be there. I think there was a mom you talked to actually was like, yeah, this some appointments are just going to get my blood pressure taken, get the thumbs up and leave. Dad doesn't need to be there at that one necessarily.
That's right. So, you know, so some moms talked about being really happy to have the dad show up every time. And in particular, when moms have, you know, have maybe had prior experience with pregnancy loss or, you know, have reason if it's a higher risk pregnancy to be particularly concerned, then it sometimes feels important to be together for every visit in case there's bad news. They want to be able to handle that and respond to that together. But for many moms where it's a healthy pregnancy, you know, towards the end of pregnancy, they're going in every other week, they're going in weekly. Mom said, you know, I don't need the dad to show up for those appointments. But, you know, anytime it's kind of a bigger deal of an appointment than I really want my partner with me.
We're talking to Tova Walsh, a researcher at UW-Madison, looking at dad's involvement in early child care and before that, prenatal care. Dad's going to appointments with pregnant partners. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Love to hear your stories as a parent. Did both partners go to prenatal appointments? If so, how often? If you're a dad, were you at these appointments? What was it like? Did it feel weird? Did you feel like a third wheel, fourth wheel? I don't know how you count. And are you involved in early childhood care for your kids? Are roles of fatherhood changing? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Tova, I threw out that one question about how does it feel in that office? Because that's something you are wondering about. If dad is there at that prenatal appointment, how is he treated by the medical staff?
Yeah. So, you know, it's a really important question. And, you know, one of the things that we're seeing in our research is that when fathers show up in prenatal care, the experiences that they have there really matter for fathers continuing to show up in pediatric care. So fathers who say when they showed up in prenatal care, they didn't really feel welcome, felt like they were in the way and not really kind of a part of things, were less likely to then show up in pediatric care, where those who had a positive experience and felt included were more likely to continue showing up after the baby was born. You know, fathers and mothers in our research have told us that they really want fathers to be made to feel welcome, that they think it's important that he be there, that, you know, at those visits, whoever is showing up is getting education and support from providers, you know, to think about a healthy pregnancy, to think about child development when it's later after birth. And, you know, and dads want to hear that too. And moms want dads to hear that too, so that everyone is best prepared to really support the baby.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Robert is with us in Madison. Robert, hi.
How you doing, man?
Good. What do you want to tell us about Robert?
Well, I mean, in light of just like, you know, I randomly listen to the station every now and then, and today's subject actually kind of hit a point. I'm a 39-year-old single father. I was at almost every single appointment. I have sole legal custody of my daughter. I mean, when it comes down to it, I mean, I feel any parent, any father should be going to any of these appointments, learning anything they can, even going to, I mean, even taking classes, pre-parenting classes, just like any mother could possibly take or anything like that. I mean, there's numerous options out there that I learned that I got support through. In her early stages, I put her in the first Head Start program. And from there, I mean, there was so many options just all around.
And Robert, I'm so glad you listened today and called in. And I wanted to ask you, kind of to set up my next question for our guest. You know, I was a dad. I hadn't had experience. I hadn't had those much in the way of classes or anything. I was kind of learning on the job. With that preparation, did you feel like you're ready to hit the ground running with taking care of a newborn?
No, it was a train wreck. I mean, honestly, it really is. I mean, nothing can honestly truly prepare you for anything. But I mean, the simple fact that I learned just how to handle things in a different situation, it was just all around. Plus, I mean, I come from a large family, and I had really good upbringing with my mother after my father passed. So, I mean, I'm just all around, I mean, just feel pretty strongly in family. And I mean, I wasn't available to be around for my first child, but I mean, when it came to my daughter Izzy here, I mean, there's nothing more joyous than being able to raise another little person who just thinks the world of everything.
Robert, thank you so much for sharing that story. Tova, what are your thoughts on Robert's experience?
Yeah, thank you so much for calling in, Robert. Actually, one thing that I wanted to say is that, you know, a number of dads who I interviewed said that part of the reason they showed up is because another dad told them to, said, you know, I went to these visits, you shouldn't miss out. It's so important. It meant a lot to me. You know, so I appreciate your call and, you know, and you kind of putting the word out for other dads that it means a lot to show up.
Yeah, thanks again for calling, Robert. And Tova, some other research you did, some surveys now, I believe, asking younger men, some dads, some not, about their knowledge of child development and childcare. And like I said, I came in feeling like I didn't have a lot of that. What kind of things did you find in that survey?
Yeah, so we did a survey with a nationally representative group of men, young men particularly, so 18 to 35-year-olds. And we chose that age range because that's the range within which the majority of men become a father for the first time. And we hope to have both fathers and, you know, people who you might think of as future fathers, so men who are not fathers, but who might in the, you know, in the years ahead become fathers, and to learn about what they know about infant development. And so, you know, we asked a series of questions that are based on things that pediatricians think parents should know, the kinds of things that pediatricians offer education about at early pediatric visits, to see what fathers were coming in with. And what we found was that, you know, there were some pretty significant gaps in knowledge, and that that suggested to us that it's really important to, you know, be encouraging fathers to attend, welcoming of fathers at these visits, so that pediatricians have the opportunity to pass on this information that they think is really important for parents to understand. And, you know, in particular, just we looked at different, you know, different domains. So things like sleep, things like discipline, things like nutrition, you know, and found that there are, you know, some men who did really terrific with these items and some men who, you know, who had more to learn. And so we just see an opportunity here by supporting fathers to attend that we can create a space where they can get support they might need as they transition to parenthood.
Let's go to Marcus now in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi. So, Rob, I'm a single father, divorced. I'm 41 years old. I have children from the marriage, and then I have children with another woman outside of it. Those moments being there for the ultrasounds and just seeing what the miracle that's been created, it's magical. That being said, I also took at one point, you know, not everyone sees it that way. I ended up losing a job because I was on a 90-day probation period and I could not take off, and I had to take a half day off to be there for one of those. And I made the choice. On the other side of that, the woman that I have the other children with, she's used those appointments because she knows how important they are to me to weaponize it, to hurt me. And it just feels absolutely helpless being a father and wanting to be there. And it's her body. She's, you know, she's the one carrying the child, but it's just, it's heartbreaking, man. I don't know what else to say.
Marcus, thanks for the call. Sorry about both those difficult experiences. And I want to go to that first one, Tova. Marcus raises a really big point. Dads, even if they want to be at those appointments, sometimes the realities of jobs and income make it really hard to get two parents at the same place at the same time. Can you talk about that, the access issue, the ability to do that?
Yeah, so thank you so much for calling, Marcus, and sharing your experience. You know, it really speaks to something that I want to emphasize, which is we find in the research kind of what you're saying, is, you know, that it's hard in particular for men with jobs that are inflexible and men who are not in a romantic relationship with the baby's mother. It's a lot harder to attend those visits, that those both represent barriers. You know, the piece of things that you were talking about in terms of your job and not being able to take time off or it costing you a job even to attend the ultrasound, you know, I think that's pretty significant. And it suggests, you know, that we need some changes in terms of, you know, policies, leave policies for folks to attend these appointments, but also potentially, you know, could have implications for the policies of healthcare providers. Like what if we made, you know, had extended hours for ultrasounds or did something so that, you know, people who work a standard day might be able to attend these appointments, you know, in the evening or at other times. You know, I definitely in my qualitative work have talked to so many dads who want to attend and who had to make a choice between, you know, competing demands and in particular work often being a conflict that prevented them from attending appointments that they really wanted to be at.
Marcus, thanks again for sharing that story, the upsides and obviously the downsides too. We're talking to Tova Walsh, assistant professor of social work at UW-Madison, talking about a research on fathers and their involvement before a baby is born, before from attending ultrasounds, learning more about child development. You can join in with your experience or your questions for our guest about her research at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk now with Tova Walsh, Assistant Professor of Social Work at UW-Madison and affiliate of the Center for Child and Family Well-Being and the Institute for Research on Poverty. Talk about more young dads wanting to get involved in the care stage, prenatal and early child with their partners. You can join in with your experiences or questions, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Patrick is with us in Fitchburg. Patrick, hi.
Hi, yes. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to say that I was involved with my children from pregnancy. I would read to my then wife when she was pregnant, and especially when I could feel the babies move, that even excited me more. So, and then it encouraged me to attend every appointment, the ultrasound, and everything. I think it was a very enjoyable and a very good learning experience for me. And I was involved in infant care and everything. And so I read books. I didn't have to take any classes. I read books regarding how to care for infants and all of that. And so now they're adults, except for the boy, he's 16 right now. And, you know, up to now, I'm involved in their lives as much as I can. Now they have to let me, but at the time they didn't have a choice.
Yeah, I know how that is, Patrick, as a dad of teenagers myself. Thank you so much for sharing that story. And Tova, it sounded like, Patrick, started with that involvement, going to those appointments, prenatal appointments, and it sounded like that gave him some momentum after they were born to be heavily involved in care. Is that a thing that you see happening?
It is, and momentum is a great word for it. And, you know, the way I think about it is that the involvement during pregnancy is really setting up a trajectory of involvement. So that involvement early on and, you know, forming a relationship with the baby as early as you know you're expecting and beginning to think about the kind of parent you want to be and learn what you need to learn to be the kind of parent you want to be, that is all, you know, feeding into kind of a lifetime of involvement with your child.
Thanks again for the call, Patrick. Marshall joins us next, calling from Madison. Marshall, hello.
Hey there. So when my daughter was born, when my daughter was born, I was really focused on being present at all the prenatal classes, prenatal visits, everything I could go to. I was very fortunate enough to be able to go to all of them until we got to that point where she had to go every week. And then I was kind of relieved that I didn't have to go every week. But my job in that was kind of to act as note taker and question asker. So if at any point outside of the meetings my wife had a thought or I had a thought, we would jot it down. And then when you're in the meeting and she's getting poked and prodded and measured and scanned, that like I would be just asking all the questions and getting all the information so that we could process it later when like we had a brain to do so. And it was really important that we had that opportunity. And like when you had a previous caller that talked about like the miracle of it all. Like I was not actually attached kind of emotionally to my kid until after she was born. I realized it was magical and amazing and like unique when it was happening, but like I didn't feel that emotional connection that I felt like a dad needed to have until several months later. Once you've kind of gone through all the sleepless nights, that's when I started to get the like, I'm here for life. This is what I want to do kind of mentality that you eventually get as a dad. Just like that whole, like, I am happy to be here, even in the suffering of it all.
Gotcha. Marshall, thank you so much. And I think that stage comes at different points for different people. But Tova, that reminds his experience as the note taker and co-question asker there. I think you even heard that from at least one of the people you talked to in some of your research.
I did. I heard that from quite a few dads, and thanks for the call, Marshall. I think, you know, I think your point, so certainly, you know, people start feeling that emotional connection at different stages. But I think what your story kind of underscores is that there's also kind of a practical element to going along to these visits and, you know, taking on some of the logistical responsibilities of pregnancy and parenting. You were going along and remembering and relaying questions and, you know, taking notes so you could remember the information. Quite a few dads talked about that, and moms too, you know, especially moms who felt anxious going into appointments. They talked about how great it was to, you know, have somebody writing things down or helping remember things that might have slipped their mind that they knew they wanted to ask their doctor. So I think it's a, you know, one great way of being a team in those appointments is to have roles like that.
Thanks a lot for that call. Time for one more caller. Carl is with us now in Madison. Carl, hello.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Carl?
Yeah, so I, in my experience, before my son was born, basically I went to go get a child's infant seat at UW Health because they have store inside the UW hospital for, you know, purchasing things like, you know, car seats and stuff. And I was introduced to a gentleman who told me about a dad class that they teach. I can't remember the name of it, but it's basically a free thing that, you know, that they, you know, take donations and stuff like that. But that was kind of a nice thing where, you know, dads that, you know, first-time dads, you know, you're kind of going into this thing blind, and it was a good experience for me because, you know, basically, you know, we as dads don't feel that emotional connection. You just, like the last caller said, you know, until after the fact. I mean, I think that's pretty common, and, you know, it was nice to kind of, have that, eye-opening experience. And there were dads that were, in that class previously that would come and bring children, you know, their infants to the class and kind of talk about their experience as well. So
fantastic. Carl, thanks for sharing that experience. And Tova, that takes me to what I want to spend our last minute or so on. You are doing some work to try to work with clinics and dads and bring more people into the experience. Can you talk a little bit about what you're working on?
Yes, I can. And thanks so much, Carl. It's neat to hear about the class that you got to be part of and the way dads are supporting other dads. So, you know, so I'm doing some research now with my UW-Madison colleague, Alvin Thomas, who is a terrific researcher studying fatherhood in Black families. And we are working together with the African American Breastfeeding Network in Milwaukee to do a needs assessment among expectant and new dads and think about, you know, learn from fathers and think about what support needs they might have in the transition to parenthood. We're learning from moms as well about the ways that they want dads to be involved in prenatal care and in other supports that they receive. The African American Breastfeeding Network is just doing tremendous work with expectant and new parents and has taken on Brooks Griffin as a father engagement specialist, and we're working with him to really build out the programming with community input. So we're excited to see when we are being really intentional about trying to engage fathers in services, how we can get dads involved in ways that will you know, strengthen families.
Tova, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tova Walsh is an assistant professor of social work and an affiliate of the Center for Child and Family Well-Being and the Institute for Research on Poverty at UW-Madison. She joined us to talk about her research on young fathers wanting to be more involved in the prenatal stage of pregnancy. Thanks to everyone who called in, and I guess happy almost Father's Day to us in just a couple days.